Hi, good afternoon, and welcome to CSIS. We're going to begin this afternoon's program. I'm Steve Morrison, Director of the Africa Program here at CSIS. I want to welcome you all and tell you how grateful we are that you've come to be with us this afternoon. We have the pleasure here today of hosting Andrew Natsios, familiar to all of you, I'm sure. He is the President's Special Envoy for Sudan, and I might add also he is the professor on the practice of diplomacy and at the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He has a long and distinguished career in development assistance, emergency relief, the big dig in Boston. He was the administrator of USAID from 2001-2005. And in that period also was a special coordinator for disaster assistance with respect to Sudan. He served in the period 89 to 91 as director of the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, OFDA, and thereafter, 91 to 93, was assistant administrator for the Bureau for Food and humanitarian assistance. He's published widely on foreign policy and humanitarian emergencies and authored in that process two books. He was a conscience here in the 90s, particularly on matters pertaining to North Korea, in a period of debate around what the proper response should be. He has served 22 years in the U.S. Army Reserve, including a stint in the period in Somalia in the 90s. Andrew, thank you so much for being with us today. We've asked him to come and speak with us on the status of international efforts with respect to Darfur. So, Andrew, the floor is yours. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. Didn't mention that the first book I wrote was published by CSIS. It was a bestseller at 1,800 copies. And it took 10 years to sell those 1,800 copies.
Still working on it.
Yes, I know. There has been measurable progress over the last few months in Darfur. The government of Sudan has accepted Resolution 1769, which was passed by the Security Council unanimously at the end of July. The major rebel factions met in Arusha in August, and talks are now set for Libya at the end of October. And for those of you who are interested in this, a figure that is more famous, who is more famous actually in the United States than he is in Darfur, Suleiman Jimous, was just released by the Sudanese government after intensive quiet diplomacy by the United Nations and the United States. But we have a lot of work to do between now and the start of talks in late October. Meetings in New York on Thursday and Friday of this week will iron out many of the details of what will happen over the next few months. Several critical issues and challenges lie ahead. Participants should be realistic, in our view, in the talks about what can be accomplished, particularly in the early stages of it. But more importantly, there is, I think, a perception among some of the participants, some of the rebels, that if they do not get every single thing they want in the agreement, they will not support it. I've told them that that's not how political negotiations work. In a democracy or an international, you don't get everything you want. The Sudanese government will not be happy with everything, and neither will the rebels. And we need to be realistic about what those expectations are. The rebels need to repair internal divisions within the movements, which in fact have accelerated, if anything, and hammer out a common position before the talks, and this process has been facilitated of rebel consolidation in terms of a common position by the United Nations and the United and the African Union. We urge all invited rebels, political leaders, and commanders to attend the talks. I cannot emphasize that enough. There's a tendency in American politics to put a black hat or a white hat on everybody. I'm and is part of our Puritan ancestral tradition, even if we're not from that tradition, that we always want to choose the bad guys and the good guys. And the fact of the matter is there are a lot of black hats, very black hats, in Darfur. There are not a lot of white hats. And I think we should cease and desist from attempting to find a lot of heroes, because there aren't many. Violence needs to stop. This has been emphasized by virtually every regional country involved in this, by the Europeans, by Ban Ki-moon, by Mr. Kanari, and certainly by the United States publicly and privately. If we go into the talks and do not have some early success on a functional cessation of hostilities, it will complicate our ability to be successful in those talks, because each time there's an incident, there'll be threats of walkouts and that sort of thing. It was very clear in our own experience in the North-South talks that the cessation of hostilities early on was a major factor in confidence building, one, and two, that allowed us to proceed with some of the negotiations. We need to find a way to include voices of ordinary people in Darfur. It is clear from my visits with leaders from four of the displaced camps, this was in July when I visited, I spent my July traveling, that there is a new sense of political identity by people in the camps. And when I said to people, in one camp I met 60 leaders who the UN and the NGOs said were representative of the opinion of the camps, and they said the only people that will represent you in the talks, and they said the only people that represent us are us. If you're not an IDP, you can't represent us. And I heard that in all from all of the four different camp leader groups that I met with. Tribal leaders, traditional leaders. I met the McDoon, for example, of the Four tribe, the largest tribe. 70% of the people in the camps are from the Four tribe. The McDoon is the next level in the hierarchy below the Sultan of the Four. The Sultan governed Darfur region for 400 years. And I met him when I was there in July. Arab groups must be included. If Arab groups in some way, through the traditional leadership system, are not included in the settlement, there's a real risk that the settlement will not be accepted and the conflict will continue. I think women's groups can play a major role in this whole effort to get inclusion, because they have been a force in Darfur for peace. And local Sudanese NGOs and professional groups. I remember one of my trips before the war started, I met with a businessmen's association, businesswomen's association. I met with a lawyer's association. There are various professional associations in Darfur that can be constructive forces. The international community needs to continue to use all pressure and leverage to keep the talks moving in a positive direction. We cannot forget that peace in Darfur and ultimately all of Sudan hinges on the successful implementation of the comprehensive peace agreement between the North and the South. If that fails, there isn't going to be any peace in Darfur. There is a tendency in the West, because of our political system and the way the media reports, to divide these conflicts as though they were in different countries. They are not in different countries. They're in one country, in Sudan. And they've been a problem for Sudan, these issues of marginalization of the periphery, since independence and from the period even before independence. And so we need to understand there is an intimate and direct connection between the aggressive and disciplined and fair implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement to peace in Darfur. At a minimum, any new agreement or amendment to the Darfur Peace Agreement of last year must address the core needs of ordinary people in Darfur, including, as a minimum, in my view, the effective security arrangements that offer civilians protection from marauding government-backed militias, bandits, and the confiscation of heavy weapons out of the hands of government-backed militias and from rebel forces as well. We cannot have disarmament of heavy weaponry from only one side. It simply does not work. There must be a provision dealing with the issue of compensation for the victims of the crisis. Guarantees of property and land rights are essential and have a profound effect on livelihoods. I think Physicians for Human Rights have written an excellent report, one of the best I've seen, on the connection between this issue of property and livelihoods and peace. The economic factors that are at work in Sudan, particularly in Darfur, have a profound effect on conflict generally. And finally, reconstruction and long-term development after there is a peace agreement signed, in our view, is critically important to address some of the longer-term causes of all three wars in Darfur that have occurred in the last 20 years. I attended visited, as the director of OFD, the first Darfur war in the last 20 years, which took place in the late 1980s. It started under Sadiq al-Mahdi when he was prime minister. He was overthrown by the current government. And then the war continued, and there was a brutal suppression by the central government of that war. That was between the Four and the Arabs. And there was a Mazalit conflict between 96, 95, 98, between the Mazalit and the Arabs. And that was brutally suppressed. Neither of these two earlier conflicts were anywhere near on the scale of the current conflict. But these wars appear to be getting worse each time. That is to say, more bloody, more destructive, with a greater loss of life, and more damage to the economy. And in a poor area, the damage that's done to the economy is something that takes a great deal of effort to repair. The symbiotic relationship, for example, between the farmers and the herders, people constantly think of them as at war with each other from biblical times, and that may well be true. There is conflict over the use of land. But the fact is that neither can exist with the other. And because the farmers, who tend to be from the Four tribe, are no longer growing crops the way they did, there are huge food problems now for the Arab tribes because the nomads have nothing to trade with in the markets. There is food in the markets, but it's not what it used to be. And that symbiotic relationship has been broken. The Arabs and the Africans tribes used to intermarry with each other. You'd frequently find an Arab or a Zagawa man marry an Arab woman and vice versa, and you'd see the tribes intermarrying with each other. That has stopped now, or it has diminished significantly, because the tribal tension has been exacerbated by the catastrophe of 2003 and 4 and the destruction of the 2,000 villages by the government and its forces. The issues I've just raised are issues that the IDPs raised with me. I asked them, I said, if you could choose the three most important issues, what would you choose? And consistently, we heard a repetition of these issues in all of the four leadership groups that I spoke with. And I might add, I talk with Jan Eliasson every week. I talk to Salim Salim. I just came back from 4 days in Europe with our allies to discuss these issues. And when they go to the camps, they hear the same thing. So we cross-check to make sure we're not getting one view from an isolated group of people. There is consistent reporting that these are the issues that count to the IDPs in the camps and to civil society. Ultimately, what will truly transform Darfur, along with the rest of Sudan, are successful elections that include Darfur and the 2009 election cycle, which is stipulated under the CPA. Guarantees on how those elections will be run should be a focus, in my personal view, of these negotiations, which will address some of the rebel demands on the issue of power sharing. Finally, we need to carve out a clear role for the AU and UN hybrid peacekeeping force in implementing the peace agreement. That mandate is in Resolution 1569. People overlook that. They only look at the issue of protecting civilians. But in the longer term, the most important role for the long-term peace of the provinces, will be the implementation of the peace accord. And that is in the resolution as a mission of this peacekeeping force. We have two important earlier agreements, the CPA and the DPA, which serve as evidence that it's possible to negotiate a political settlement to resolve Sudan's profound problems. If the Sudanese government made a more serious effort at implementing the provisions of these two agreements, it would be a powerful incentive to the rebels to negotiate more seriously. Ironically, right now, at this moment, the biggest obstacle to the talks is not the government of Sudan. It is some of the rebel groups. And I say some because some rebel groups are acting very responsibly. They are trying to participate in the process, and others are refusing to participate, making outlandish demands despite significant international pressure to the contrary. Other groups continue to use violence to enhance their position prior to the talks. Particularly disturbing in this regard is the recent attack by the Justice and Equality Movement and the SLA Unity rebel movement in Kordofan, a neighboring province that is at peace, that killed over 40 police officers and triggered retaliatory government bombings in Haskani, which was the location of a city in Darfur that these two rebel groups came from. Finally, these for those rebels who are committed to talks, we must ensure that they have the help and the space they need for internal dialogue so that they can consolidate their positions, reunify their movements, and establish effective communication links prior to the start of the negotiations. Despite important progress in Arusha, there are still serious divisions among rebel groups and between rebel leaders and field commanders, and we must work to help the rebel groups repair these divisions and establish effective channels of communications. On a recent trip to Darfur, my most important discussions were with tribal elders, people in the camps, women's groups, and local NGOs. And what they told me is they were fed up with and frustrated with political bickering among rebel leaders. If the rebel leaders don't step up and represent them on the issues they care about most, security, compensation, the return of their land and development, they are ready to represent themselves, they told me. Another obstacle to peace is escalating violence among Arab tribes in Darfur. They are fighting over land they have taken from the Africans who were displaced by the burning of the 2,000 villages in the ethnic cleansing campaign of 2003 and 4. And these Arab tribes are now trying to take this land, and they're fighting with each other over it. A very dangerous precedent. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced this year, but most of them are Arab, actually, and most of it caused by this fighting between tribes over this land, none of it which belongs to them. Many Arabs in Darfur did not participate in Janjaweed atrocities and do not believe the government represents them. We must be sure that Arab tribes are included in the talks, as I mentioned earlier. One of the most encouraging developments has been watching the international community come together in support of the current AU-UN efforts. I think those efforts had a slow start earlier in the year. They've sped up. They've accelerated. They're staffing properly the offices in Khartoum that are needed to back up all of the complex operational plans that are being put in place. I think China has played a very useful role behind the scenes in using its leverage to get the government to accept Security Council Resolution 1769 and to participate in the upcoming talks. It has also committed 300 engineering troops to the hybrid forest, which will be arriving in a few weeks. And they've made other promises in some detail, which I don't want to discuss publicly, which I think are very constructive. We have also used our influence to press rebel leaders to attend the talks and encourage the GOS to make constructive steps, such as the recent release, as I mentioned earlier, of Suleiman Jamous, one of the SLM leaders. One of the major topics of discussion for the upcoming New York talks will be how we as an international committee continue to use our leverage and influence to keep the talks on track. Together with our allies, we are discussing measures, including sanctions, to discourage anyone on any side from taking actions that will jeopardize the talks. This includes the government of Sudan, rebel groups, and runaway rebel factions who signed side deals with Khartoum for personal gain. Let me make a final point in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. The implementation of the CPA is significantly behind schedule, and its failure risks a return to war between the North and the South. I don't think we're at that point yet. There are warning signs. We need to try to catch this early rather than wait too late. Limited progress on Abyei, which is a city or a region of one of the three disputed areas under the CPA that has several codicils to it, is of enormous traditional importance to the largest southern tribe, the Dinkas. The Dinka kings come from Abyei. It has been an issue of considerable emotion, and there was a conflict that almost started 2 weeks ago between the northern and southern armies over this city. The failure of the GOS to deploy forces to redeploy forces in the south, north, by July, the deadline of July 9th provided for in the CPA was a serious violation. Although 85% of the forces have been redeployed, we still want all of them under the agreement to be redeployed. Delays in the formation of the joint integrated units is a problem. Delays on key legislation and funding for the census and for the elections is concerning us. We must work to get the CPA back on track, and we are hopeful that the incoming SRSG, the Special Representative of the Secretary General, Ashraf Ghazi, who I know well, used to be ambassador to the United States from Pakistan, will be helpful in this regard. We also must reinvigorate the assessment and evaluation committee mandated to monitor CPA implementation. We are troubled by the undermining of this important commission in Khartoum. In closing, let me say that I am more optimistic now than I have been in a long time, but it is a guarded optimism. We have seen some improvement on the part of the government of Sudan. They have accepted the hybrid force, improved the operating environment for aid agencies, and agreed to talks, something I was not sure would happen several months ago. Many important rebel factions are committed to talks and are doing the hard work necessary to build unity and develop a common negotiating position, but some are not. Important voices that were not included in the Abuja round last year, IDPs, women's groups, tribal leaders, and local NGOs, are explicitly included in this round of negotiation. The international community is united behind the AU-UN team and is committed to taking necessary positive and negative measures, including the possibility of new sanctions to censure those who obstruct the talks. I now would be happy to answer any questions. If there are no questions, I can leave.
Thank you very much, Barbara Slavin from USA Today. Nice to see you again.
How are you, Barbara?
Very well, thank you. To what do you attribute Khartoum's new reasonableness, and will it last? And then just some numeric-type questions. How many rebel groups are there? How many people have been killed? How many people displaced? Thanks.
A lot of questions here. We do not have absolute assurance of exactly how the Sudanese government makes its decisions. In fact, if someone asked how members of Congress made their decisions, or the state legislature that I was a member of for 12, I mean, they're complex processes. So we can't quantify how they made decisions. However, it is very clear that the international focus of, in terms of the news media, the advocacy groups, and people think of it only in the United States. There are a lot of Africans very upset over what is happening. African leaders make comments to me, and there have been demonstrations in Africa and student groups and other associations in Africa protesting what's happening. Certainly, the student movement, the STAND movement that I know of well at Georgetown, it's in fact it started at Georgetown in the country, has had an effect. We know from our own analysis that the president's sanctions that were announced at the end of April has had, while there was lots of comments made about them, we know the effect they're having. They're quite profound. And we know that they've had an effect because of the changed rhetoric around them now with respect to people in Sudan. And if you look at all of the critical moments in which decisions have been made, they have been made since that date that those were announced. So I think it's a combination of media coverage, international pressure, the advocacy campaign, and the sanctions of the United States and the leadership of the international community. But most importantly, if you put anyone in a corner and you give them no way out, you're going to have an explosion, not a solution. And so it's very important that we not see all this pressure as simply a way of punishing a government most people don't like very much. It needs to be pressure to find a constructive way out. And so it's very important that we see the introduction of this 24,000-person force under 1769, the process of political solution, and other measures that are being taken as a way out, constructive way out, for a solution to this crisis. I haven't seen the latest numbers on death rates, but that's something we don't track. Other agencies track it. I can try to find them for you, Barbara. I tracked them before, and they're lower now than they were last year, for example. The biggest problem is with population displacement, and that is, as I said, caused by this fighting between Arab tribes over this land that had belonged and still belongs, at least in my view, to the African tribes that are in the camps. In the back? I guess I'm asking all the reporters. I should be asking the ordinary people in the audience questions.
Hide in the yes. Back, radio folk. I wanted to ask you about whether you're satisfied with the planning at the United Nations for this hybrid force, because there have been a couple of dates that have slipped, and what the U.S. is going to offer this hybrid. How is the U.S. going to help speed up this process and make it a reality?
There's a lot of planning going on. It's not a matter of what the planning is. It's a matter of what the execution is. Our problem in all of these conflicts is not planning. It's usually not even funding. It's execution, because the environment in which we're working is so complicated and so unstable and so violent that it's very difficult to get a lot of the stuff done that people think is very simple here. You turn a light switch on here, and you always assume the lights go on. That is not what happens. Or you turn the water on, the water comes out that you can drink. These seem like small things. They are not small things when you're in certain areas of the world. So I am actually sympathetic to the pressure the UN is under because they have four large-scale deployments going on. Some of them already took place, but this is the largest number of UN troops that have ever been in the aggregate in peacekeeping operations in the world at the same time. And we have other events around the world that have required the UN, the same office that is doing the deployment for Darfur. So we're working with them. We have lots of people doing planning with them. I've met with some of our planners on the military side on this. I'm not going to discuss publicly exactly what we're doing because some of it's in the preparation stage at this point, but we are being helpful. Yes? How are you, Noriko? If you ask me a hard question, I will be very upset. Go ahead. I'm just joking. Go ahead.
Sorry, Professor, my question is, I think you mentioned that there is a need to include, I mean, every functions of rebels. However, when I was in Darfur, when I got carjacked, and then there were
Your car was hijacked in Darfur?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Happened to be, yeah. Yes. So there are like 7-8 armed men, and they said, I mean, I don't know whether it's true or not, but they said they are one faction.
Seven or eight men are one faction.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I get this idea from that experience that so the faction of rebel groups can be that small.
Yes.
Right?
That is
so
correct.
Do you have any criteria in your mind to choose participants to pick participants from rebels? You cannot include every single faction. That's my first question.
This is a very difficult question. Noriko is one of my students. If I had known she was asking these questions, I may have not advertised this to my class. This is one of the really difficult questions that Jan Eliasson and Salim Slim are dealing with. Who to invite and who not to invite. I have to say, some of what is happening in Darfur is criminality. They are looting trucks, and they're selling them, and they're making money. And they have no political agenda. In fact, most of these groups want the thing to continue because the more chaos there is, the more money they make. And we need to make a distinction between criminality and political movements. And it gets a little gray sometimes. Sometimes the rebel groups engage in criminality to get resources to support themselves. So this is an issue. I don't want to go into the detail as to how this is being done, but there is a very, very detailed analysis has been done, a mapping of what is going on. Our estimate is that there are 14 rebel factions. However, I won't tell you which regional power, a friend of mine, a senior person in the intelligence community, said there are 22. I said, how do you count them? He said, Andrew, it's so complicated. We have our own system for counting. So it is a difficult subject, and it has to be done properly. But including 7 or 8 carjackers as a negotiating team does not work very well for me. Yes, sir. I know you very well. Yes.
How are you going to include the Arabs? Are they going to...
You mean
to
the civil society and the chiefs and the women's group and all?
Yes, but you said it's important to include the Arabs. Yes, there is no sustainable peace in Darfur without including
Absolutely
the Arabs.
Absolutely correct.
Absolutely, we agree on that. However, the trick is how to include them in the negotiation table.
Yes.
Are they going to be a third party? The rebels on the one side, the government on the one side, and that is going to open a kind of forum because my people,
Steve,
the Bertie of
come
Eastern
here,
Darfur...
This sophisticated audience would start asking very... The right questions. That is another one of the critical issues. Jan has and Salim have a memo before them with different options as to how to do this. We all know it cannot be they're going to go out and talk to them once in Darfur and then forget about them. They've got to be involved in something other than an ad hoc way in a regularized process. This is, however, extremely complicated. The more people, the more numbers of people involved in this, the greater likelihood of breakdown. So we have to balance the efficiency of a process with a limited number of people with a need for inclusivity and broad support once the agreement is reached. One way of dealing with obstructionist rebel leaders, and there are many of them at this point, is to say to the people in the camps, It's not what they like. Do you like this agreement? Do you support this agreement? And if I had a choice between trusting the clergy and the mosques and the women's groups and the NGOs and the IDP camp leaders, who, by the way, when I talk to them, they're very reasonable. They're not asking for ridiculous things. And they're not being demagogues about it either. I think, actually, they could be a constraint on more outlandish demands that are being made for entirely political reasons. So you're right. Jan and I have discussed what the options are. Yeah, you know, they haven't made a decision yet, but they're the right options. Let me just put it that way. And we know if this is done wrong, we're going to put the talks at risk. Yes, sir.
Dmitry Ivanov with law firm of Akin Gump.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
My name is Dmitry Ivanov with the law firm of Akin Gump.
Okay.
As you know, a number of U.S. states have passed Sudan divestment acts. Do you think the current administration support this divestment campaign on the state level? And do you think the administration will support the Sudan divestment bills in the House and in the Senate? And third question, do you think the administration would be willing to target CNPC and other foreign companies operating in the Sudan's energy sector?
Well, let me put it to you this way. The purpose of all pain in diplomacy is to change the decision-making processes of people participating in whatever negotiation or war or conflict you're involved in. That's the purpose of it. And I think there's been a huge amount of focus on exactly the nature of the pain instead of the purpose of it. Okay, so what we need to look at now is what are we trying to do in terms of the end? And the end is to get people on the rebel side and the government side who are being inflexible to be flexible. And so from my perspective, we should reorient the debate over all of the different sticks that are being discussed in the United States toward whether we're going too far or we're not going far enough, and also the timing of it. Timing is critically important. If you punish the rebels or the Sudanese government after they've done something constructive, they come back to me and say, wait a second, Andrew. You told me to do these things. You applied pressure on us. We did them. Now you're applying more pressure. When are you going to stop applying the pressure since we did what you told us to do? That's what they say to me. And I don't actually have a very good answer to that. So my suggestion is we reorient the debate in the United States on this issue, these sorts of issues. Yes, right here.
Hi, thank you. Nicole Finneman from the Public International Law and Policy Group. I'd like to know what your views on the location choice of Tripoli are. What, if any, role will it play in the success or non-success of the talks? And beyond that, are neighboring states being given any voice in the talks? Should they be?
I sat down. I had my small staff of four people work with me. So many of them had come from AID with me. And we analyzed the weaknesses in the Abuja process. What is it that worked? What is it that did not work? And what we're trying to do is design a process working, and Jan Eliasson has done the same thing, and so has Salim and other people. It's not just us that are doing it. Okay, we reached very, very similar conclusions, and we are attempting now to deal with that issue. One of the weaknesses was not including the regional players that have a profound geostrategic interest in what happens to Sudan in the process last year. They may have been there, but they weren't participants. And so we made a decision early on that we were going to work constructively, but these are the conditions. It's got to be transparent, it's got to be open, and it's got to be constructive. And some of the regional powers have been transparent and constructive, and we appreciate that. Some of them have not been, okay? They go back and forth. I only can tell you, my first trip to Libya was this year. I mean, I've gone to Libya, I think, three or four times. Ali Traki is my counterpart. He's the minister for Africa. He's a former foreign minister. Ali Traki and I talk all the time. When I've asked him to do things that I thought were constructive, Ali Traki has done them, or his government has done them. And I only can tell you, in the two big meetings we had, one of which, the second of which, made a critical difference, in Tripoli, which was in July, Ali Trakey at critical moments intervened when things were getting off track to work with the Western powers and the African Union and the UN to get them back on track. So I'm going to go by that. What counts to me is how they act now. What's happened in the past, I'm not going to go by that. I'm going to go back what's happened since I got involved. And as long as countries in the region are constructive in the process, we want them included. We want them included, however, constructively and transparent. That goes for all of them. So we'll see how things unfold. I mean, there's a lot of controversy over the venue, a lot of controversy. Yes, sir. You know, if you ask me a hard question, it's going to damage Canadian-American relations.
I'll try not to.
I'm just joking.
You were speaking of obstructionist rebel leaders. I was wondering if you could tell me how, from your experience in the camps, how important you think Abdul Wahid is to the process and whether he's somebody who has to be dealt with or can be worked around.
One, let me first say that we need to have all of the invited rebel leaders attend. It's very important that they attend. I don't expect all of them will, for various reasons, some of which are directly related to the talks themselves, others related to timing and internal problems within the movements. What happens when a civil war goes on for too long is the very weak control leaders have over followers and commanders begins to atomize and deteriorate. And so you have in many of the movements, like GEM, which was the most disciplined and militant and aggressive and organized of all of movements, now has a big split in it. And these are internal dynamics that we don't have much control of. We have a little understanding, but not complete understanding. They have something to do with sometimes with ethnicity, control over wealth, the operating style of the leader. I mean, if you look at the history of the SPLA and the SPLM in southern Sudan, John Garang dealt with this for 22 years. He became, however, highly skilled at dealing with it, and by the end, he had a hierarchy where he was the head of it, and he was able to negotiate as one person. That facilitated substantially the arrival of or the talks that we had between the North and South that led to the CPA. Abdul Wahid has a following in Darfur. He is a Fur. It's the largest tribe in Darfur. I have to say, if you talk to people in the camps, Abdul Wahid is not their first interest. It is getting back to their homes and their farms and everything else. And I think what's important, particularly when we have a discussion about the participation of civil society and of women's groups and NGOs and professional associations and the religious community and the traditional leaders, the reason they're there is to be a transparency force, because sometimes people say things at press conferences and any peace conference that may not have anything to do with what's really happening in the negotiations. They may do it for other reasons. And we need a objective, respected outside force of leaders from Darfur who are a check on everybody participating. And I think that's very important to remember. But Abdul Wahid is going to be invited. And we urge him very strongly to attend so that his people and his movement are represented at the talks. Yes, sir.
Andy Sullivan with Reuters. You've mentioned several times that rebels are making unreasonable demands.
I said some people were making. I didn't say some. But it happens to be some rebel leaders, yes.
Can you characterize those demands?
I'd rather not. You can read them. They're public statements. I'm not going to repeat them because it just makes things worse.
Can you say what would be a more reasonable approach?
Then that would get me into the negotiations, which I don't want to do.
Okay.
This is not between the United States and the government of Sudan and the rebels. It's between the rebels. Let them deal with that. Yes. The lady here in the end seat. Yes.
Hi, thank you very much for addressing us. My name is Laura Turner. I'm with the United Nations. I just wanted to ask...
Which office of the United Nations?
The World Food Program.
Ah, my favorite.
I just wanted to ask, I'm heartened to hear that your analysis is that the CPA is not on the brink of collapse, but
no.
Not everyone feels so
that.
Heartened by or feels so positive about it. And I'm just wondering, the U.S. was a driving force through Mr. Danforth in the CPA, and some people think that if the U.S. or the other lead governments that were in the CPA process took as much of an interest now as they did back then, that perhaps things would get on track again. Do you have any advice, not only for your government, but in general, what the international community should do?
Well, as opposed to when I was in the aid community, where public statements were very useful frequently, I've learned in the diplomacy sometimes it is better not to say things publicly. Some of diplomacy is conducted very quietly. There is an intense discussion now among the Western powers, the North and the South, on the CPA. There's a heavy focus in the international system because all of us realize, I personally was involved in negotiating the CPA. Colin Powell asked me, because I was close to the Southerners, to participate. And so I have a personal interest in this, having been close to the Southerners for 18 years now. Garang was a friend of mine. That it succeed. It is something we already have. It's not something we're trying to get. Okay? It's taken me a long time to understand why certain provisions of the CPA are not implemented. What I used to do is go in. I've raised these issues with President Bashir and the entire leadership in the North each time. It's like a broken record. Jan Eliasson's mentioned it. Salim mentions it, over and over again. The question is, which I'm not going to deal with publicly, as to why they are resisting things. And it's a very complex set of rationales on their part, some of which, when you start to understand, you understand they could have very serious political consequences in the North depending on how the compromises are worked out in the remaining parts of the CPA. And the government is not a strong government now. It's not a strong government, contrary to how Westerners see it. The regional powers and my friends in Africa say they're not in a strong position at all. There's a real risk of state fragility here, in my view. And so we need to think through, and I've been doing that, and I've realized now I miscalculated why they were resisting some of these, and we're trying to now take different diplomatic routes to influence the resolution of these issues. Because they're under certain pressures, the Sudanese government, and unless we deal with those pressures, they're not going to change their reason for not implementing the CPA. They're not going to become more cooperative unless we change the pressures they're under. And that's what we're beginning to look at this point. Then it's not easy. The Sudanese don't sit there and say, well, the reason we're not doing this is the following five reasons. We'll give you a paper on it and help us with this. That's not how it works. You have to sort of discover how it is by good intelligence and analysis. And that's what we're doing. I'm being vague now because it's a very complicated subject. But we know there's a connection. There's a lot of international effort going into it now. And it is being conducted, this diplomacy, at the various highest levels of our governments. Yes. Yes, Steve.
Getting the recalcitrant rebel leaders to the table requires also sort of denying them their external support, or reducing their external support in some fashion, or making it more difficult, certainly. And can you talk a little bit about what's happening with the Sarkozy government, the deployments into Chad and CAR, the threat of sanctions that Gordon Brown and Sarkozy put forward, and Ban Ki-moon's engagement and the efforts to get the Libyans to be less of a spoiler and more of a facilitator of peace. These seem to be
the last sentence?
Gaddafi coming in.
Yes.
These seem to be some of the major big turning points of the last 60 days, 90 days, that have brought us to this point, along with the Chinese. If you could comment.
The election of President Sarkozy in France has changed the European calculus on this, and there appears to be a new energy along with – it was not that the French government or the British government before were not interested in this, but Sarkozy put in a particular person who I've known for many years as the foreign minister, Bernard Kouchner, who, of course, knows Africa, knows conflicts because that's what he did for much of his adult life. And I've talked with and had breakfast with and met with and talked with at length with Kouchner about these issues. We think in the U.S. government that the French proposal, which is now, I don't think it's quite a European proposal, but it's on the edge of that happening, as I understand it, is a constructive, major new initiative that will send several important messages. One is that attacks on civilians are going to have consequences. And we think the message that will send will be very powerful. Two, the border area between Chad and Sudan was an area of conflict for a year and a half, which complicated our ability to deal with the political problems in Darfur. There was, in fact, a war between between Sudan and Chad for a year and a half that was quite violent. A lot of people got killed in it. And they used each other's rebel movements as fronts for their national conflict. That now, for at least 8 months, six months, has been quiet. The ceasefire that Libya helped negotiate has worked. There were several other attempts before at ceasefires that were a failure. This one appears to be working. We pray it will continue. We encourage the Chadian and Sudanese government to continue the current ceasefire. If the fight starts again, we got a big problem. Because while that war is going on, there's not going to be any resolution of the Darfur crisis. So that's very important. We think that, the introduction of these European troops will, in fact, stabilize that situation between Chad and Sudan and make it more difficult for uncontrolled rebel movements on either side of the border sort of using their influence over either of those two governments that could draw them into a conflict again. So I think this stabilizes that first. So there are two very good reasons to support it. I think this is a good idea. It comes from the Europeans, and we support it. We compliment President Sarkozy for doing this. I've talked with other European leaders at senior levels about this idea, and it looks like it's got legs on it. Yes?
Ken Bacon, Refugees International. Thank you for these comments. I wanted to go back to what you called a crucial issue, which was the return of property and the ability to return to villages. Right now, as you pointed out, Arab groups are fighting over the spoils, so to speak. The government in Khartoum is very weak. And even though the UN is putting in a much larger force, I ask this question, who can enforce the return to villages? Who can enforce the return of property? Do you see a mechanism for that on the horizon, and how will that be ratified in any sort of peace agreement coming out of Libya or elsewhere?
Whenever I go to Darfur, I meet with the new political leaders, but I also meet with the traditional leaders, the sheikhs, the chiefs, the Makhdoom, the Nazirs, and they have some influence over their tribe. Some of them have great influence. The Nazir of the southern Rizagat, the highest tribal traditional leader, kept the southern Rizagat tribe out of the conflict because he said, you're going to destroy the province. When he was, Bashir asked him to provide troops for the Janjaweed, and he said, absolutely not, I'm not doing it. So these men have influence, substantial influence, and we believe if the interests of the Arab tribes are considered in all this, that they can be a force of restraint to deal with some of these traditional land issues. These land issues, I have to say, are one of the critical issues. If it isn't dealt with privately, we won't have a peace agreement. Now, I might add that there has been a discovery by an Egyptian-American hydrologist at Boston University of much more extensive underground aquifers in northern, the arid area of Darfur, I think it's 1,000 meters down. I don't know how far down it is. It's quite deep, but it can be reached. It's apparently a huge supply of water. We all know that there's been the largest underground aquifer of water in the world. It's called the Great Nubian Sandstone Aquifer. It's in southwestern Egypt, southeastern Libya, and northern Sudan. We did not know until the professor at BU did his surveys that this is much more an extensive underground reservoir than we had realized. President Bashir has announced, we have to see whether it actually happens, of course, the digging of 1,000 wells. Now, this doesn't create enormous confidence in me. However, the United Nations has brought in what is called deep well drilling equipment, and they are beginning to prospect. And USAID, I know, was working with some private hydrologists with the Sudanese government. They were part of this process to begin to do the aerial surveys of what areas the wells, because you can tell from the air when you're dealing with fractured bedrock and underground reservoirs to decide where to dig the wells. So research has been done in studies that could open up areas of land in the north that are now really not very usable, even by some of the camel herders, because it's just basically desert. So it's possible that some of the land issues could be dealt with by the water development in the north. But that remains to be seen. It's simply promising. It's simply promising. And there is an international effort working on that now.
But I guess it raises the question of, there's a long time scheme for both of these. We're not going to have water instantly. And
no,
if you're tying the outcome of peace talks to the development of this aquifer, we could be talking years, maybe.
No, this is, I'm just telling you that.
I understand.
Sort of,
but I just, going back to the land, I'm not sure that that developing the aquifer will be a major solution to the land return problem. So I just wanted you to address.
It won't in the immediate term, Ken, but it will in the longer term. It could in the longer term. It could, depending on what the surveys show and the drilling shows. Without going into enormous detail, I've been through personally in the NGO community and AID return efforts before. The great bulk of returns in all post-conflict situations are not organized by the Fred Cuny did extensive studies of this. He published a couple of books before he died on this subject. We all think that we organize the returns of people after conflict. That's really not true. We do maybe 20% of the most difficult, people who are not ambulatory, they're elderly, you know. But most people go back on their own. Our job is to make sure they get back safely to their villages. There's no one else there when they get there, so we don't have another war. And that there is some kinds of services like wells drilled. These are shallow wells now, so that they can live in those villages. And that is something the UN has done with the NGOs and the ICRC and the IOM around the world in several dozen cases. So we know how to do this. And there's so much interest in this internationally that I think the money will be there for the returns to be done. The question is getting the political agreement so we can make it safe for people to return. Because no one's going to return if they think they're going to get killed on the way. Yes.
Iselin, Georgetown University. I have two questions for you, Professor. First is, what is going to be the basis of the talks? Is the DPA going to be the basis? And then second of all, can you please comment on the GEM leader today, his statement, or yesterday, said that if the talks go through or do not go through, they will call for an independent country of Darfur?
Yeah, Khalil Ibrahim was censured or was sanctioned by President Bush because he has been making some, we think, irresponsible statements and doing some things that are obstructionist. He's the head of GEM. He was the head of GEM. His movement has divided in half, and his field commanders have separated from him, many of his field commanders. He's the one that made the comment that you just referred to, which I don't think was very helpful. What was the first question? The basis of the talks will be, according to the November 16th Addis Ababa agreement, which was... I was there leading the U.S. delegation. Kofi Annan shared it with Kanari, and there were 30 countries there. It was a big international. We basically created a plan that we've been carrying out, and we've finally been making some progress the last 90 days on this, substantial progress. The basis, we've all agreed, would be the DPA. The rebels resisted this at the beginning, and now they're talking more reasonably. Many people who are the most vociferously opposed to the DPA being the base have never read the DPA. Many of these issues are dealt with in the DPA, I don't think adequately, and I think that's why some thoughtful rebel leaders have resisted the DPA. But the government of Sudan has indicated to me privately they are willing to compromise on some of these issues in writing some amendments or codicils or annexes to the DPA. I think we may have to use our diplomatic skills to reframe exactly what we're doing, but we have a basis, which is a document that has a lot of stuff in it that's very useful. And the rebels have now admitted that there's parts of the DPA that are constructive. We need to build on that. It's taken a lot of conversation with diplomats and the rebels and the government to try to get where we're moving a little bit closer to a common base for negotiation. Yes, sir.
OK, Okay. Ibrahim Al-Badawi from the World Bank. I would like to ask a couple of questions. One, to the extent that democratic transition to democracy is very important for the CPA as well as for any resolution for Darfur. And in view of the fact that many observers of Sudan believe that the group that is now in power within the ruling party, they are likely to be the most concerned about being liable to legal suits or whatever because of potential atrocities that they might have been involved in. Is there any plans for giving them assurances that, to promote them to actually to cooperate in terms of the transition to democracy? That's my first question. My second question regards the political opposition in the north, especially the Ummah Party. On view that the Arabs component of Darfur are important to be involved, do you see any role for the Ummah Party to promote that kind of cooperation, especially since just 20 years ago, this party has taken all of Darfur in the last free election in 1986. Thank you.
You must be Sudanese if you know all this about Darfur. The first question I would just answer, I think what happens between now and the elections will influence the answer to your first question. If the government is cooperative, the elections are open and free and fair, I think people will be more favorably disposed. If they're not, and the elections are, there's an abusive process, I think there's going to be a reluctance for people to be flexible on these issues. And finally, it's very important that the Sudanese people be consulted in all this. I mean, it's not our country. And some of these arrangements post-election are going to have to be dealt with by the Sudanese people, by any election that takes place in any new parliament. The Ummah Party is, of course, the party of Sadiq al-Mahdi, who was the prime minister in 1989, who was overthrown by the current government. And Sadiq al-Mahdi's great-grandfather, of course, was a Mahdi in the 1870s, a major religious figure in the country. It's a celebrated name, an old family, a powerful family that still is very influential. When I went my last trip in July, I met with Ummah Party members and the other two or three big parties in Sudan, in Darfur. And actually, some of the most interesting conversations I had about what was happening in the province, economically and politically, were from the traditional party leaders, because they have a lot of insight. They're shrewd people, they're very thoughtful people, and they know what's going on. Do I think the traditional parties in Sudan, not just the Ummah Party, but the other parties, can play a role in the peace process? Yes, I do. I'm sure all of them, they're going to run for office in 2009, I expect. I think, though, that there has been such a catastrophic trauma that Darfur has gone through that it's very difficult to predict whether the Ummah Party will pick up seats or lose seats or become more powerful. I don't know. It's certainly wars change and atrocities change people's calculation. So we can't predict that now. But they have a role to play because they're a moderating force. They're traditional parties that go back for decades, and they do have a base of support, particularly among the middle-aged and older people. The younger people, may not know them as well because there have been no real elections in Darfur or in Sudan for, 20 years now? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Natsios. Alex Meister from Save Darfur. You mentioned a few minutes ago the importance of refugees and IDPs being able to return to their homes. Could you comment a bit on the reports we've been hearing of forced resettlement or government-sponsored resettlement of non-Darfuris from Chad and Niger into those villages?
I would not use the term forced resettlement. That's the problem. They'll be given very good land. At least the reporting we've seen indicates that. There are conflicting reports on how high the volume is of people. One report is it's 30,000. Another report is 90,000. And then another report said that the movement was 30,000, but only a portion of those were resettled onto land that belonged to other tribes. And there are various theories as to what's happening. We are analyzing this right now, Alex, and when we get a little bit better feel for how extensive this is as a problem, get back to you. I keep raising the issue because I believe my comments, which are widely read in Sudan, may act, I hope, as a constraint on any further settlement of this kind, because if you take very good agricultural land that belong to the tribes that are in the camps and you give that land to people who come from other countries, even if they're nomadic people who may at some point 30 years ago lived in Sudan, it's simply going to increase the risk of failure of the peace talks. We know this is going on. The question is the degree to which it's going on. When we get a better handle on that, I will make more comments publicly. But I urge the Sudanese government and other local government officials to cease and desist from this kind of resettlement because it will make a peace settlement more difficult. One more back here, Nuriko, because you asked. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Scott Stetton with Oxfam. As you know, there's been multiple ceasefire agreements that have been signed through the years, 2004 in Jemena, the DPA itself, and these have failed to hold. My first question is, what is the U.S. going to do to ensure that parties do not attack each other during the peace agreements, other than just sanctions? Because I'm unsure of how sanctions will affect a group of men running around the desert with guns. In any other way except for prohibiting them from traveling outside the country. Is there a carrot to the stick, in other words? Are there incentives? The other question relates to the relationship between Chad and Sudan. As you rightly said, that the relationship between these two countries is central for peace in Darfur. As you may know, the Congress this week is debating the Defense Authorization Bill, the Senate is, which has a provision that would allow the U.S. to upgrade the Abyshe Air Base in Chad, foreseeably to enforce a no-fly zone or some sort of attack on Chad. How do you think this would affect the relationship between the government of Chad and Sudan, and whether that's a helpful act? Thanks.
Well, to call the Abyshe runway an air base would be a slight exaggeration. Having landed on it just barely, when I went to speak with the rebels in January, I am personally aware of it, I kept saying, so where's the air base? And they said, you're on the air base. I said, I thought there was a giant French military base here. So that's the military base, that little house over there. So it's not an air base, it's a little strip. I'm not going to comment on that specific piece of legislation, except to say I think when we do stuff in the United States or in Europe, we need to look at the consequences of what we're doing. I'm just going to make this as a general request. The likely consequences in the country in which we're actually doing the work. It's one thing how we see it from here. It's quite another how it's received in the field. And it may well be, I haven't thought about exactly the consequence, but I think anything that destabilizes the relationship between Sudan and Chad right now is a very bad idea. I don't know if this would have that effect. I'd have to think about it. But that's the standard we should use. And I'm not sure we always use that standard when we do advocacy things. And we think through. I mean, people are trying to be helpful, and I understand them. People from Congress ask me, what should we do, Andrew? And I think it's not just what we do, it's also when we do it. It's one thing to have done that when the two sides were fighting. But now that there's a ceasefire that's actually holding, and it looks like it's going to continue, we don't want to disrupt it. We don't want to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, so to speak, the peacekeeping egg. That was the first question. Carrots and sticks with the rebels. That's the other thing is people made lots of comments on the president's sanctions, you know, back and forth. It's irrelevant what we think of them. What's relevant is how they think of them. And I can tell you, we know from experience, even people out in the desert, they ask us, if we do this, are we going to be sanctioned by name? They ask us that. We had, during the Arusha talks, rebel leaders would not go unless they were assured they were not going to be sanctioned. Now, I don't think they know for sure what that means. All I know is that they asked us repeatedly and as to what was going to happen to them if the sanctions went into effect or didn't go into effect. So it does have an effect, particularly since most of the rebels see the United States as having carried their moral cause to the extent that the people who they represent had a cause in terms of the atrocities that were committed against them. You may disagree with whether that's true or not, but the people in the camps think their big protectors was the United States. And I took some very cynical reporters with me, went through the camps to disprove what I just said, and they came back and said they were astonished at the comments they were hearing. So we have a lot of sway with the rebels. Before the Arusha talks, Jan Eliasson gave me a list of people who were not planning to attend and said, Andrew, they won't come. I said, okay. And I sat and called them from vacation in Maine. And they went. Okay, so I think we can influence that. We can use our moral suasion and leverage, which it has a limit to it. But it does have an effect when you talk to them and when you explain to them. And they get upset over things that, you know, they say, why did you make this decision? I said, I didn't make that decision. It was made by one other country we didn't even agree with. That calms them down. I think, you know, a lot of the decision-making calculus is based on information. And if they have the wrong information, you know, factually the wrong information, they make wrong decisions sometimes. So I find just talking with them has an effect. One last question for someone who didn't ask one. Yes?
How would you
characterize China's diplomatic role in the run-up to the election? I think the Chinese election is sort of like a locomotive, that it started a little slowly and it's speeding up. And it really, they're actually thinking of new things to do that we aren't even asking them to do. And so Ambassador Liu was here, and he went over some of the things, and I said, I don't remember what's talking. She said, no, we thought of this in Beijing. You think it's helpful? I said, it's very helpful. Please do it. So I think the Chinese are making an effort. Now, some people in this country may not think it's enough. They may have other objections. I am very happy with the role the Chinese are playing. I think it's constructive. We're having, you know, we have constant conversations with each other. Ambassador Liu, I forgot how many times I've met with him now. So it is a constructive role, and there's much more deep involvement by them in what is going on. It's not simply making public statements or making a call. It's much more extensive than that. They're operationally getting involved in facilitating the arrival of the UN troops, which we think is very helpful. Thank you very much.
Let me just remind everyone here, President Mohai from Botswana will be here on Friday morning at 9:30 for a public address on a range of issues. Please join us if you care to. Thank you.